Although the recession officially ended 2.5 years ago, unemployment is still over 9%, and as the protests in downtown Manhattan reveal, so the public anger is becoming focused on how Wall Street has dealt with the crisis. Matt Taibbi has explored both the state of the economy and public frustration with Wall Street in his articles for Rolling Stone and in his books, most recently Griftopia, which has just been released in a paperback edition by Spiegel & Grau. I'm very pleased that it brings him back to our show today. Hello.
How are you doing?
Most of the, you can hear I'm not doing as good as I would like to be. Most of the protesting about the economy until recently has been from the right, most notably from the Tea Party activists. Are the Occupy Wall Street protests a belated response from the left?
I think they are. The protests in Wall Street are not just about the economy, but they're also about the politics behind the economy. I think there's a general sense that there's a commingling of the financial services industry and the government in a way that's corrupt and that's not beneficial for ordinary people, and that this has impacted national politics because these companies have such a massive influence over our politicians. I think they're upset about the politics of it, and I think they're upset about the fact that the gap between the haves and have-nots continues to grow.
Some of them are claiming that they were inspired by the Arab Spring.
Well, I mean, I think that's, it's funny that the two things might have a common cause. I think there are a lot of people who would argue that the Arab Spring was caused in part by Wall Street because of speculation in the commodities markets led to rising food prices that were unnatural, and that was really the trigger behind a lot of these protests. There was widespread public discontent because there was so much pressure being put on ordinary people over there. And, you know, we have people upset about the same thing here in the States.
They were also upset about the political processes in their countries. And it's being suggested that this isn't good news for President Obama because the protesters represent a similar demographic to the ones who supported his campaign for president.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, for the entire span of Obama's presidency, I continually hear the same thing over and over again from people on Wall Street, which is that Barack Obama missed a really huge opportunity at the very beginning of his presidency when the economy was in shambles after the collapse of the stock market and what happened in the fall of 2008. You know, he had an opportunity then to step in and sort of set himself up as the defender of the ordinary person of Main Street, and instead he really kind of sided with Wall Street, and that, I think, lost him credibility with these people.
Well, Ron Suskind's book suggests that he did want to break up the Citigroup, but that his economic advisors just ignored him.
Well, look who Barack Obama's economic advisors were. His team was almost entirely composed of people who were loyal to Bob Rubin, who was a Citigroup executive. So, and a lot of the people who are on Obama's economic team were responsible back in the Clinton days for the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, which was specifically done in order to facilitate the Citigroup merger. So there was no way he was ever going to break up Citi.
And then there was also the connection to one of your favorite companies, Goldman Sachs.
Right.
The Obama campaign received substantial contributions from Goldman Sachs, and people have seen some kind of a connection there. Is Goldman Sachs likely to contribute as strongly in the next campaign?
I think, first of all, Goldman Sachs was the largest private contributor to Barack Obama's presidential campaign in 2008. I think they're likely to be up there in the top five again this time around. But, you know, all the investment banks are very smart about the way they contribute to political campaigns. They never let up, and they always contribute heavily to both sides. So no matter who's in office, they have a friend there.
But I keep on reading that people on Wall Street and in business in general in this country consider Barack Obama to be an enemy of of business. Would they support the Republican candidate if a credible one came along?
Sure. I mean, but it's all relative. I mean, look, if Barack Obama only gives Wall Street 94% of what they want and the Republicans would give him 100% of what they want, would they prefer the Republicans? Absolutely. But the reality is the Bush and Obama administrations, particularly with regard to their response to the Wall Street crisis, have represented absolute continuity. The bailout program was exactly the same from one administration to the other, and there really hasn't been a significant change. You saw a little bit of reform with Dodd-Frank that you wouldn't have seen if it had been a Republican presidency, but it wasn't substantive.
Some pundits have criticized the protesters for a lack of clear and unified goals, but participants say that the overall goal of their protest is clear, that they're calling for Wall Street to be made accountable for much of the mess that we're in. Do you think that this movement is likely to have much of an impact?
You know, I'm of two minds about this. I love the protests. I went out there a couple of times. Obviously, this is an issue that's near and dear to my heart. I've been working on it for 4 years, and I've been waiting for this kind of public response the entire time. I think, you know, the critics who say that they don't have a clearly articulated message, I mean, I think they do have a point to a degree, because they haven't submitted really a list of demands or specific principles. But on the other hand, I think these protests are important because they could eventually provide the framework for the public support that people would need to make reforms in Washington.
But unlike the Tea Party, they don't have anybody in Washington who represents their thinking.
Well, they might soon. I mean, you know, there are a few people. I mean, there are certainly people like Bernie Sanders and, you know, Jeff Merkley and Carl Levin and some other people in the Senate who are allies, either wholly or in part, with this movement. I think if Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts gets into office, she'll be an important champion for this movement. And I think increasingly there are politicians who recognize that this is an area where there's a lot of political hay to be made, because if you look at the composition of these protests, there are Ron Paul supporters in there as well. I mean, there's common ground there between the right and the left where a very canny politician could go in and make a really positive impact.
My guest is Matt Taibbi, whose book Griftopia was a New York Times bestseller when it was released last year. It's now been updated and expanded and issued in a paperback edition by Spiegel and Grau. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, many people have commented on the limited media coverage, especially for these protests, compared to what happened during the early days of the Tea Party. How much of any movement's effectiveness is its ability to get the press to write about it? Because most of the media coverage that I've seen has focused on the police response rather than what the protesters are saying.
Sure, and you know that to me was seriously problematic. If you look at everything that's happened on Wall Street, you know, in the last 4 or 5 years, and finally you have this protest on Wall Street, and the one headline that comes out of the first week of Wall Street is that some old cop maced a couple of, you know, college students. You know, that's a problem, because there's so much that these people are legitimately angry about, and that message has not been communicated. Either that or the media is just simply not reporting it, and it's very problematic.
Have you spoken to any of the people who work on Wall Street about their reaction to all of this?
Yeah, and I have, and I think, you know, the kind of people that I talk to are largely sympathetic for the most part, you know, to the protesters. I think there are a lot of people in the industry who are very upset about the corruption, the sort of intermingling of the government and some of the bigger companies. But I think, you know, they would wish that these protests were more pointed and more specific in their agenda, which might still happen. You know, I understand they released a list of general principles today, so we might still get that.
You've added some material to Griftopia for the paperback edition. How much has changed since the hardcover was published?
You know, I think it's really more of the same. I think, I mean, when I sat down to write this book, it was right at the beginning of the crisis, and as I was writing it, the entire bailout program was being implemented. And, you know, this book really covers a whole range of corrupt practices, from the mortgage-backed securities, securitization, foreclosure, the corruption in, you know, regional debt markets and interest rate swaps like in Jefferson County, Alabama. All that stuff is still going on. There's still corruption in virtually every corner of the financial universe, and it hasn't really been checked in any meaningful way. And so I think these things are still relevant.
You added some articles that you had already published in Rolling Stone to this book. But I was surprised that you didn't include your article entitled "Why Isn't Wall Street in Jail?" from the March 2011 issue of Rolling Stone.
Yeah, you know, I think it was probably that came out just as we were putting this paper back to bed. So, but then, you know, that's a topic I'm going to be taking up a little bit in my next book. So, I think that's and that incidentally is one of the key issues that is motivating these people down on in the Wall Street protests, the fact that there hasn't been a proper regulatory response I think that's an issue that's still very much important to those people.
And it's 6 months after you wrote that article. Do we have a better answer to the title question now than when you wrote it?
I think people generally understand that that the regulatory system has been completely compromised and captured by Wall Street. You know, we've seen that the SEC, the CFTC, all the regulatory agencies, the Fed, the traditional banking regulators like the OCC and the OTS, these are regulators that 20, 25 years ago were routinely referring thousands of cases for criminal prosecutions or investigations, and now they just don't do that anymore. There haven't been any real high-level prosecutions of any executives, and nobody has gone to jail.
Yeah, there seems to be a notion that Wall Street tycoons are above jail time in the justice system. There was a time when someone like Michael Milken was sent to jail.
Absolutely. And look at the SNL crisis, for instance. We saw in the response to that crisis somewhere between 1,200 and 1,500 bankers actually physically go to jail. And here we have a much, much huger scandal with the fraud involving mortgage-backed securities. It makes the SNL crisis look like a blip in the radar, and nobody went to jail.
And who would be the prosecutor here? Is this a federal situation, or would it be somebody, the New York State Attorney General?
It's both. I think the federal prosecutors certainly have avenues to pursue with all of these companies, because a lot of these crimes were committed across state lines and even internationally. But certainly all 50 of the state attorneys general have plenty of cases to sift through. Even if they just were to look at abuses in the mortgage industry, they'd be doing these cases for the end of eternity if they actually took them up.
The Securities and Exchange Commission has charged one of your favorite targets, Goldman Sachs, with misstating and omitting key facts about certain financial products in the subprime mortgage market. Do you have a sense of whether they've changed their business practices in the wake of the many investigations, articles, hearings, and greater security over the past 3 years?
Certainly, I understand from a number of sources that Goldman Sachs has changed its public relations strategy. I think they've probably changed things like, what do we write in emails to each other? What do we say to each other over the telephone? What do we put in our sales materials? I think they're much more careful about those things. But I haven't seen any evidence that they've changed their core belief system. We can always hope, I guess, but my sense is no.
Well, there was a huge reaction to the article you wrote in 2009 in Rolling Stone, The Great American Bubble Machine, which condemned Goldman Sachs as what you colorfully called its vampire squid policies. And now that's become almost a common term associated with Goldman Sachs. You must be very proud. But do you think, is this a good indicator for how the common perception of Goldman Sachs has changed since the article was published?
I think so. I think certainly the public, and these protests that are going on now are evidence of this. The public has a very, very different perception about what Wall Street is than it did 4 or 5 years ago. And I think that's a result of two things. It's, on the one hand, it's because the media and people like me have focused on that. But more importantly, it's because millions of ordinary people have come into contact with Wall Street and in a very, very intimate way, whether it's they've been foreclosed upon or had credit card judgments against them. There's this massive collision between Main Street and Wall Street that's taken place in the last 5 years, and that's resulted in that change of attitude.
Well, you include a quote from Lloyd Blankfein, Goldman Sachs' CEO, during the Senate hearings in 2010, when he said that he didn't think his company was obligated to tell his customers that they were being sold a defective product.
Right.
Didn't feel obligated?
Right, right. Of course.
And nobody said anything?
No, and of course the law is very explicit that you have to disclose any, quote-unquote adverse elements that to any, if you're going to sell a car to somebody and the brakes are defective, you have to disclose that to the person who's buying the product. Goldman Sachs obviously doesn't agree. And this is another place where the financial services industry has a very different place in the American landscape than other industries. If you had any other industry, if it was selling cars or, you know, hair care products, whatever it was, if they were defective on the scale that a lot of these financial products were defective, there would be massive settlements and people in jail all over the landscape.
But this is not just Goldman Sachs. We're talking Bank of America. Many other companies are being
all
accused.
All of them. Bank of America, J.P. Morgan Chase, Citigroup, you know, Goldman Sachs, Deutsche Bank. I mean, you name it. They've all been engaged in selling these products.
I heard a news report the other day that many banks have pulled out of TARP early because they wanted to be able to pay their top executives huge bonuses again.
Sure. Yeah, that's always been a prime motivation to repay the TARP loans. The TARP, most people think of the TARP as the entire bailout. That was the $800 billion that Washington, in cash essentially, that the government injected into these banks. The reality was the TARP was only a small part of the bailout. Most of the bailout was done in guarantees and in subsidies in other areas. There were Fed programs that bought up bad assets that the banks had on their balance sheets. So it was very, very smart business for the banks to go off and repay those TARP loans quickly so that they could pay themselves their huge bonuses again but continue to receive the other subsidies.
Rumors are that Goldman Sachs will be giving smaller bonuses this year.
Sure, and I think that's going to be true across the board in the industry because obviously things are tightening up. In the last couple of years, Wall Street has really been surviving at the behest of the government, which has been helping support everybody through these money printing programs called quantitative easing. There was QE1 and QE2, and that was essentially a program to dump billions, actually trillions of dollars into Wall Street and help support the financial markets. And those programs are ending. So the banks are going to make less money now, and so they're going to have to tighten their belts a little bit.
Or they're going to have to charge me for using my debit card.
Right, absolutely. I mean, the
Bank there are all of sorts America, of other little things that they seem to be doing. A little here, a little there can add up.
Oh, that latest, I actually got a call from a Senate staffer about that last Friday. Bank of America has made this incredible decision that they're going to charge every customer $5 a month to use their, whether or not they even use their debit cards. This is precisely the thing that the Dodd-Frank bill intended to target, these kinds of specious charges, and they're just going to do it and give themselves an extra couple billion dollars of revenue.
Wouldn't that lead a lot of their customers to leave?
Theoretically, I think that's they certainly could, and I think a lot of customers are going to leave Bank of America anyway because the bank has recently been downgraded and it's almost nearly junk status now, its credit rating. I can't imagine that too many people would feel good about having a Bank of America bank account at this point, but all the banks are eventually going to do this sort of thing, and they all do it, whether it's ATM fees or hidden fees and, mortgage servicing or credit card accounts or whatever. You're being churned and chipped away at whether you know it or not most of the time.
Matt Taibbi's book, Griftopia, which was a New York Times bestseller, has just been issued in an updated and expanded edition by Spiegel and Grau in paperback. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Matt Taibbi. He has his book, Griftopia, New York Times bestseller, has just been issued in an updated and expanded edition by Spiegel and Grau in a paperback edition. We have a number of questions from listeners that I thought I would address before we go on and talk about things in the book. One listener asks, does the recent case of the UBS trader who lost $2 billion show just how little has changed in the way that Wall Street does business overseas in its overseas operations? UBS has said that he was just a rogue trader.
Absolutely. It shows that, one of the themes that is repeated, I repeatedly come across in my reporting and interviewing people on Wall Street is the guy who's honest or who works in the quality control section of a bank who sounds the alarm and is completely ignored by everybody in the higher levels of the company. I come across that over and over and over again, and that's exactly what happened in the UBS instance. Here you have a quote-unquote rogue trader who made some really bad decisions, and somehow the bank wasn't aware of it until the company had lost $1 billion.
That's a lot of money to not be aware of.
Exactly. They have no real quality control at these companies. And even when they do have good quality control, the higher level executives have the power to override and ignore these people, because they tend to be the quality control guys are almost always lower paid. They just don't have the status at the companies that the other guys do, the traders do, and so that's why these things happen.
A listener in Westchester writes, Wall Street firms hire lobbyists who keep their eye on the ball, regardless of what Wall Street individuals think, or if, as Ron Suskind suggested, might have been willing to accept in 2009 as new regulation, the lobbyists were never waver in fighting regulations. They and trade group lobbyists also give the CEOs plausible deniability. The CEOs may say that they would agree to changes, but the lobbyists have different marching orders. I work for a company with lobbyists and have seen this.
That's absolutely true. I remember during the negotiations over the Dodd-Frank bill, I was visiting a lot of the Senate offices while I was covering that story, and there were 2,000 financial services industry lobbyists that were roaming the halls of the Congress during that entire period. There was one instance where I physically didn't have a place to stand in the waiting room of one of the offices because there were so many of these guys in there. And on the other side of the table, there were maybe 40 or 50 volunteer people who were trying to get real reforms pushed through. That just shows you the scale of the problem. Ordinary people do not have a seat at the table when these things are being negotiated.
Chicago sold its parking meters in 2008 to a sovereign wealth fund organized by Morgan Stanley. Was Chicago really that broke?
Well, they definitely had financial problems, but these sorts of sales that are of public infrastructure, which are going on all over the country and are being used by executives in basically every state of the union, they're extremely short-sighted. What they tend to do is they'll take some public asset like parking meters or a parking garage or an airport or a highway, and they'll put it up for a lease essentially for 50 or 75 years. They'll sell it at an enormous discount, and then the investors will end up reaping the benefits for the next, half a century. But the state only gets the one-time payment that year. So the politician gets off. He gets to solve his immediate problem, but then he pushes the problem down the road.
Do you think that people in Chicago are regretting that deal?
Absolutely. I think they probably regretted it even before it happened. Certainly there were a lot of people who voted for it, the aldermen. Some of them weren't educated about what the deal actually meant. But think about what happened there. Not only is Chicago going to be deprived of all that revenue, but now their parking meters are owned by a completely unaccountable private company that, for instance, if an alderman wants to do a parking holiday where he wants to allow people to park without having to pay for Lincoln's birthday or for Christmas, they can't do that anymore. The company won't allow them. You have no local control over your own property anymore. And this is happening all over the country. Highways, parking meters, garages, prisons, everywhere. It's just they're selling off infrastructure at a discount.
You described the McCarran-Ferguson Act as, quote, more shameful chapter in our history than the Jim Crow laws. That's pretty strong language. Why do you think it's so bad for the country?
Well, I just think that the health insurance, exempting, allowing the insurance companies to have that sort of exemption from regulation is.
Was it enacted?
I believe it was 1946.
Uh-huh. So this is something that's been with us for a long time?
Yeah. In fact, I think the Senator McCarran, I think, is actually was the senator who provided the basis for the famous character in The Godfather who had a horse head left in his... Not, no, there was the other guy in Godfather Part 2, the corrupt senator who offered Corleone nothing. But this was his legacy, was the unrestrained insurance industry.
And what was the argument for that? Why would insurance companies be exempt from regulations?
I think I can't remember even
Do you think that President Obama could have passed the Affordable Care Act if he had also tried to change McCarran-Ferguson?
Yeah, I think so. I think I don't know. The insurance companies have so much support in the Congress that it would have been difficult to get that passed even if they wanted.
What about the American Jobs Act, which he says he wants to see on his desk really soon, which is kind of unlikely? Do you think some version of it will pass before the 2012 elections?
No, I mean, maybe. It's hard to say. I think with the Republicans in control of you know, the Congress, it'll be difficult to get any kind of stimulus act passed.
Well, opponents are citing a study that claims the legislation would cost American taxpayers $200,000 for every job it's intended to create.
Yeah, and you know, obviously after the initial stimulus program, there was an enormous amount of criticism levied at the Obama administration that they didn't create real and lasting jobs. And you know, I don't know the extent to which that's true, but clearly that all of that is going to be used as ammunition against any new jobs program.
But you think we should have a jobs program?
I think certainly if you had a massive bailout for Wall Street, if you had, you know, $10 trillion committed to rescuing banks from all the bad decisions that they made over the last decade and a half or so, that certainly there some kind of relief had to be there for homeowners and the unemployed. But it just hasn't been there in the same amounts. It's just that the amount of political will that's been aroused against any kind of public expenditure for ordinary people, it just there hasn't been that same level of outrage at the same kind of generosity afforded to the big banks.
A listener named Matt asks, is there a suitable or acceptable place for financial firms as you see it? Is it likely that more regulation of them would shift this power to foreign financial firms?
I get that question asked that question all the time, and I am, you know, my critique of Wall Street, if you read it closely, is not a socialist critique. It's not an anti-bank critique. It's a very much a capitalist critique, and it comes from hundreds of interviews from people within the industry who love the industry, who want traditional investment banking and financial services to continue. The problem, as they see it, is that there's been this corruption of the industry, that these gigantic too-big-to-fail industries have too tight a relationship with the government that allows them to behave recklessly without any regard for consequence. If we could just sever that toxic relationship between the government and these gigantic companies, then it would restore the normal capitalist processes. And I think, you know, the ingenuity and the creativity of American business would win out.
But usually you get rid of politicians through the electoral process, and you say the election process in this country is a beautifully choreographed entertainment.
Yeah, obviously I've lost some enthusiasm for the American electoral process over the years in covering it, probably just because the amount of money that both parties receive from these gigantic financial companies makes it impossible for voters to have real choices when it comes to trying to pick somebody who's going to push through real reforms to fix this mess. Your choices are really the Republican Party, which is 100% in the tank for Wall Street, and the Democrats, who have traditionally been, you know, almost as bad. And that doesn't leave us with any real choices.
But we also are watching the Republicans go from candidate to candidate. Michelle Bachmann is in the lead, and then she loses support, and then Rick Perry. Right now, Herman Cain seems to be getting a lot of support. Chris Christie,
yep,
is being encouraged by a wide range of people, from Henry Kissinger to Nancy Reagan, to run. I don't know whether he'll be any more entertaining ultimately, or whether Barack Obama will be any more entertaining in the future.
I think this is going to be, and all the reporters that I know who are covering the election, they all expect this to be, if nothing else, a supremely, I don't know if entertaining is the right word, compelling election season. I think there's a tremendous amount of raw anger on both sides of the equation, and there are likely to be explosive conflicts between all of the candidates and the two parties in the next election year. That doesn't mean, though, necessarily that these politicians really have a whole lot to offer in terms of real solutions, or that they're all that different from each other on some key issues.
But what we wind up with is a lot of gotcha things.
Sure.
We spend less time on whether people are consistent in what they're claiming. There's an article in Today's Times about how members of Congress want to end tax breaks for special interests, except the ones that are located in their home states.
Oh, absolutely. We consistently ignore all of these claims and reforms that the politicians say that they're for. I mean, I remember very clearly listening to Barack Obama on numerous occasions claim that he was going to end the Bush tax cuts and repeal things like the carried interest tax break, for instance, which allows hedge fund managers to pay only 15% of the on their taxes while the rest of us pay, you know, 28, 35, or whatever. And 4 years later, neither of those things have happened, and we continue to have that inequity in the tax system. But it's that never becomes the issue in political campaign reporting. It always comes down to personality or some whether or not he's got his hand over his heart or some ridiculous thing like that.
Last month, the Federal Reserve announced that it would pursue a strategy they've called Operation Twist that's right. aimed at boosting the bond market. Can you explain how it's supposed to work, and do you think it will work?
Yeah, I don't really understand how Operation Twist works from what I understand. What I do know is that there was an enormous expectation before the announcement of Operation Twist that there was going to be QE3, which is the quantitative easing, is this program where they were essentially creating hundreds of billions of dollars out of thin air. And
we're running out of Queen Elizabeth's.
Right, exactly. Yeah, they were going to do QE3, which is another sort of quote-unquote asset purchasing program where the Fed would go in and buy things like mortgage-backed securities on the market and essentially be the market to help prop up the financial markets. When that didn't happen, that's why when Bernanke came out with this Operation Twist, which from what I understand is just a much smaller scale program of just moving risk from one side of the balance sheet to the other, the markets reacted very violently to that because they were expecting that welfare check again, and they didn't get it.
And then we have the problem of global concerns about the European debt crisis, which have added a lot of uncertainty into the markets and fears of another recession. Have efforts to put stronger regulations in place in Europe and around the world been effective?
I don't think so.
I mean, we doing any worse than they are or any better?
You know, it's hard to say. I think a lot of people that I've talked to have stressed that some efforts overseas that seem to be more interesting than ours. For instance, there was a call in England to force people in the financial services industry to tie their compensation to long-term performance as opposed to short-term performance, which would be an enormous change in our system where you get your bonuses for doing something this year. And if that had been in place here, that might have helped avert the 2008 crisis. There's a movement towards something called ring fencing in England, which would help separate the investment banking industry from commercial banking. And if we did that, which we decided not to do in Dodd-Frank, that would be a great thing. But overall, are they doing anything much more radical than we are? I don't think so.
Securities and Exchange Commission just released a new report that criticizes credit agencies' reports. Is that going to have much of an effect?
No, because after Dodd-Frank, they didn't do enough during that reform process to force the ratings agencies to change their business model. You know, the real problem is that the ratings agencies are financially dependent upon the same people that they're rating. And until they change that, they're not going to really eliminate the problem completely of these puffed up ratings.
Scott from Baltimore asks, how does Matt stay sane in light of all of his reporting on this historically unprecedented situation? Well, we'll have to ask you the next time you show up because we've run out of time. But Matt's book, Griftopia, is now available in paperback in an updated and expanded edition. It is published by Spiegel and Grau. And Matt, it's always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much for coming by again today.
Thank you, Leonard. Feel better, I hope.
Me too. I don't want to go through another coughing fit on the air.